Real life
superpowers.
I remember that I moved to the States, to New York, to start the US entity of the company. It was 2013, I think. And we opened an office in New York, and then we started to hire the go-to-market people, and we started to grow. And then we had a board meeting, and we decided to host the board meeting in our office in New York. I told you about Dan Avida that, again, I really love and look up to. He came to our office, and I was a bit arrogant. I told him, Dan, look at our office. See how many people we have in New York. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. We're growing the sales and the team. And everything is great. And then Dan, in his, again, super smart, he told me, Aviad, hold your horses, okay? If I need to sum it up, the only thing you were you did very successful is to keep your head above the water long enough and not dying. If you do that long enough, at some point you'll get your chance. You'll start to see the positive thing that you know, the coins that start to trickle down in the machine. And it was very humbling discussion with him that made me think how important is the grit or the resilience. And to keep on, you know, to the next step, not the entire journey. Every time you meet a challenge and not giving up.
Welcome to another episode of Real Life Superpowers. I'm Noa Eshed, co-hosting with Onen Manipaz. In this episode, we speak with Aviad Harel, the managing partner at Team 8, a global VC with deep domain expertise that builds and invests in companies specializing in enterprise technologies, cyber, AI, and fintech. He's a seasoned angel investor and advisor to numerous startups, VCs, and executives. Before joining Team 8, he co-founded Sisense, a powerhouse in the business intelligence space. Under his leadership, Sisense thrived, achieving $150 million in annual revenue and growing to over 100 employees. He's seen the highs and lows of the startup world, and his journey is full of valuable lessons. Let's dive into his insights and journey.
Real life
superpowers.
Up in the sky, it's a bird,
it's a plane.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
It's alive.
Real life
superpowers.
Aviad, welcome to Real Life Superpowers.
Happy to be here.
What are you up to these days?
Well, today I am part of Team 8. I'm a managing partner at Team 8. And we're focused on early stage investment, mostly around enterprise software.
And how long have you been at Team 8?
So I joined Team 8 about 2 years ago, a bit less, I think. And prior to that, in my previous life, I was a founder of a BI and analytics company called Sisense that I started 18 years ago. It's a long period of time when I say it like that. I spent there about 15 years, give or take, holding all the various positions you can think of.
And was that your first venture?
Yeah. We started Sisense, me and my co-founder, at the third year at Reichman University. When we met at Reichman University, all of us went to study computer science, and we decided the third year to start Sisense.
So it's not very trivial. Like there are sometimes, you know, there are courses for entrepreneurship. Like did something sort of kickstart this, or maybe was there some army background? Like how it's not that trivial to be a student and then to just start that, although it does happen. But even when it does, it rarely, you know, evolves into what you did. So tell us more about that.
So that's a great story. I think, part of it are trivial, part of it are, I attribute completely to luck. But unlike many Israeli startups, we did not meet at the right army intelligence units. None of us, by the way. We met at computer science studies at Reichman University. We became good friends at the first year. At the last year, we grouped together in a course called Open Project, I think this was the name of the course. It's a year-long course, right? Two semesters in which you choose a market, a problem, a suggested approach, how to tackle it. We had the lecturer, one of the doctor, I think he was a doctor. He was our guide and helped us through the process. And it was an exciting project. And at the end of the year, we understood we have something potentially bigger than a university course. And we decided to start the company, to start Sisense.
That is so interesting. Like, were there other students that actually also, you know, continued with their venture, or did is there any historical use case other than you guys that actually ended up exploiting that way?
Well, I think there are quite few startups that incubated at Reichman University at the computer science. Again, unlike the others or many of the others, we did not attend the entrepreneurial program out of Reichman University. We were a bit lazy, a bit, I guess. So we focused on the computer science studies. But there are a few other very successful startups that started at Reichman University. I think Yotpo is one of them that you probably know, and the GIFT Project, and quite a few others.
Does the university have equity in such cases?
Not in our case, at least, because it had very little with the university. I mean, we started exploring this vertical through that project, but the university had very, very little with what we built and the foundation of the company.
The Reichman University actually has one of the better entrepreneurs. It has Sam Zell's entrepreneurship program.
And it's a great program.
It's a great program. That's the GIFT Project that was sold to eBay. It was also from there. The Zell, so Sam Zell didn't interest you as a student? It was an interesting, investor?
So first, when I attended Reichman University, I think this program was very, very new, the Zell program. It's an excellent program, and few of the very well-known Israeli entrepreneur grew at this program. We didn't go there. I don't have a great explanation for that, but we didn't attend that.
That's a shame, because I was actually the panel there, so that's why I missed you. On that note, did you drop out of the college?
So no, we ended the third year. However, after we started Sisense, we decided to sign up for a master's degree in computer science at Reichman University. We had that romantic idea that we can start a company and do the master's degree in computer science. At the first semester, closer to the exams, we understood we didn't do anything related to the academy, and we decided to drop from the master's degree, all of us.
But I'm so curious, like, why was a master's degree appealing to you in computer science?
I don't think we invested a lot of brain power to figure out whether it's appealing or not. It as I mentioned, it sounded to us a bit romantic, right? We'll study, we'll start a company, we'll be able to harmonize both of them together. Well, we didn't.
Okay, that's fair. And then, like, these are three people that you met during school. So much can go wrong, especially starting a company with no previous experience leading such ventures. And this is something that started growing and quite rapidly as such, right?
Yeah. Well, rapidly, especially when you consider back the days when we started it. As I mentioned, I spent about 15 years at Sisense, so I won't call it a quick journey.
No, it's not. But I'm saying you guys were students and you hooked up to start a venture, and it sounds like you were sort of playing around. You know, you're also playing around with the idea of a master's, and it seemed like it's a little experiment. In general, it also seems like you take things quite lightly. And I'm not saying that to imply in any way that you don't take things seriously and invest yourself in them. But I mean, you don't seem to let things take you down in a sense, like, or be intimidated by the size and the impact and the potential of what this could evolve to. And I'm just wondering, like, was there a moment when you sort of caught yourself and told yourself, wow, this is really big and it's a little scary?
So it's a great question. I don't think that at the beginning we had that type of thinking. Obviously, many times later or throughout the journey, we had this conversation and you know, internal thinking. When we started, I mean, I think the thing, at least I'll speak about myself. The thing that led me were the joy of creation, creating, you know, from thin air something, the building part of this journey, the connection with my co-founders, which I deeply love, right? We were able to create a great connection between us. And we spent a lot of time together, which we enjoy tremendously, I think. Curiosity, I think, what it means to start a new business. What is a business? Until that point, at least myself, I wrote a computer code. I didn't build a business in my life. So I was completely intrigued by that. And I had tons of curiosity, and I was very young and careless. Little did I have to lose as well. So at least at that point of time, I think I was less cautious about these kinds of things.
So these three friends, okay? You met these three friends. You were probably all bachelors, right?
Yeah.
So the relationship goes through mutual studies. And then you work for 15 years with these people. So I'm imagining, as an entrepreneur, you have this type of relationship where you're hanging out, doing everything together. And slowly there's like changes in life, right? Yeah, probably marriage, probably kids, whatever, all kinds of problems. Okay, so how do you learn how to work differently? Like, there's a lot of people who work, they have that certain, you know, we're hanging out together and we're doing this entrepreneurship. And then it turns to something, I don't know, some people call it mature, but it's something totally different, right? So how do you manage that?
And I just want to add, I'm thinking of, I once heard Paul McCartney on the Beatles anthology. He was saying there was some point where he thought of a poem that goes something along the lines of, those wedding bells are breaking up those old childhood friendships of mine.
So I think you captured something interesting here, because we started, when we started Sessions, we were all bachelors, right? We rented apartments close to the university. The first office of Sisense, I wouldn't call it an office. It looked like a bachelor pad more than an office. Back in the days, by the way, it's not too politically correct today, but we were all smokers. We smoked cigarettes. And in our office, there were only us. So we smoked in the office. So I think it's very hard to find an office today when you come in and you see on each table like an ashtray, and when you walk in the office, there is a fog of smoke when you get in. But this is what we did back then. I met my future to be my wife about 8 months after we started the company, something like that. Very early in the process, I remember my wife, God bless her, I love her, she told me, well, if we're going to marry, I'm going to be your wife, but I know you will always have a mistress, and this is Sisense. And I think it's an interesting way to describe the situation back at the day. We worked very hard.
Sisense was there before. It sounds like the mistress is the opposite.
Yeah, right?
Could be. Sisense was there before. We were all delighted by the joy of creation. So we worked our asses off. At the beginning, completely misguided, right? The first few years were stagnated. We didn't know what we're doing. But we worked very, very hard and we enjoyed every minute out of it. I remember we didn't get very early to the office, right? Still, young people, bachelors, got there at, 10:30 at the morning, but we stayed until like 10 p.m., 11 p.m. And after that, we met at the bar, at the closest bar. So it was a lifestyle, I think, in many ways.
And how long did that go on for?
I think until we started to hire employees.
When was that?
It was 2 years into the process. We started very slow. This is a, by the way, I meet many founders today. It's a different journey, what it used to be back then and what the expectation of a new startup today. Back then, you didn't raise a lot of money like you do today or compared to today, but the expectation was that at the first couple of years, you build a product, right? In most of the cases. Today, the expectation is that after less than a year, you start to have revenue. We didn't have the beginning of the product after the first year. And it was different ball game.
But why? Did you raise money during that time?
Yes, from angel investors when we began. And it wasn't a big success because we ran out of money every once in a while. And we went back to our angel investors and we begged for more money. And at some point, rightfully, they told us, no more. You need to raise up institutional money. Go to the VC route. And we started that route very unsuccessfully. It was very hard for us.
What was the difference? Like, why was the institutional a lot different than raising money?
I think it was us, being frank. We didn't know how to manage that process. We didn't know exactly how to pitch what we are doing. We didn't build a product professionally like we should have. We didn't build the go-to-market properly in a way that VC, this is my interpretation of what happened, that VCs can look at it and understand the business model. So we didn't. This is why it was so hard.
But why is that different from the angel investors? I mean, it sounds like you got quite a lot of funding through angels and you obviously have to pitch that to them as well. So where is that pretty huge gap then?
We had a very special first angel investor. He was a father of one of the founders. So it was easier for us to pitch it. So we had an easier start in that regard. By the way, it has pros and cons to the fact we raise money. Maybe if we didn't have more forgiving angel investor, we could have been more focused and quicker to get our shit together.
But today, okay, so you actually are the investor. Like, this is what you do. So what would Aviad of today's say to Aviad in the beginning when he started that angel investor? What would you tell him to do differently?
That's a great question, and I've been thinking about it a lot. Not just because I turned into an investor even before that. To begin with, we started very unprofessionally, right? Somebody told us BI and analytics is a good market to be at. And we said, cool, maybe you're right. We didn't, at least many of us, I wasn't able to spell the name of the biggest competitor back then. It was very non-organized and professional way to start the company. If you compare it to founders that I see today, when they come to meet me, they are few orders of magnitude more professional. They have bigger understanding of how you model the market, you model the problem, how you validate it. Back in the days, we didn't know how to do that. Maybe others knew, but I think generally speaking, the discipline of building companies were different and less professional than it is today. I see it very clearly.
But Aviad, I feel like you're downplaying what you've accomplished because it can't be that everything was wrong. And also, you're sort of making me think that at the end of the day, it's sort of like the difference between, you know, going to business school and Ivy League and getting all the details right versus getting the actual real life experience, which you did. So to an extent, maybe what you were doing was actually the right way to go. Maybe all these over analysis versus, you know, getting like a POC and just hitting the ground running, trying, experimenting, getting feedback loops, which sort of sounds like what you did, because I am assuming that this, despite the way you're describing this, you were actually with your ear on the ground and you were actually learning as you grew, and or not grew even, but as you moved. So were you really that off?
At the beginning, I would argue that yes, you are spot on that we were good learners and listeners to the situation, and constantly we improved, right? Well, we cannot avoid from the outcomes, right? So eventually we got our shit together, as I mentioned, and we started to build something that made sense, not only in our perspective, but from VC perspective. And then after we got the motion, we started to get the recognition and get the you know, the attention from top tier VCs as well. But it took us some time. Now, regarding your question, whether maybe it's the right way or the wrong way, I don't know. I'll give you the pros and cons. The way we took demanded, or that one of the outcomes is that many times we had to bring money into the company not in a favorable terms. It's not because the company grew and we needed more capital to continue or to keep up the growth. We needed capital because we needed to survive. It has impact on the cap table, by dilution and stuff like that. Whether it's better or worse, it has a cost. Right? It doesn't come without a cost. Yet it was our journey and our way. And I think in some perspective, we can mark it as a success eventually.
Oh, I think that goes without saying. Do you sometimes like see people coming to you, like entrepreneurs, to pitch? And I'm assuming not all of them are actually, you know, by the book, like you're supposed to be these days. Do you sometimes get to hear pitches where you feel like, oh, I see Aviad from back then and I see potential and I'm going to nurture that?
So, yes, I'm not a big fan of templates. However, templates in many cases are created because of a reason. Something that works well most of the time is being templatized. I think one common denominator that I see with today's founders, they strikes to me, I'm aggregating, but they strikes to me as more professional in how they think about the problem, how they think about building venture, how they think about go to market. Maybe it's because of the founders. Probably a lot of it is because of the knowledge that is being curated along the years of what it means to build a company. And you have many more people to consult with, and you have ecosystem of very experienced angel investors. 18 years ago, it wasn't the case, at least in Israel, in our small swamp in Israel.
Okay, that's fair. And then circling back to those early days. So you were three. And you were all majoring in the same thing.
Four. We were four.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. And you were all studying computer science, right?
Yeah.
How do you decide who is in charge of what?
That's a great question. I think when we started, we all were focused on building the core technology. So we wrote code. At the beginning of the company, we were all writing code. And it was one of us, Eldad Farkas, that was the CEO back in the days, one of the founders, he had a little bit more of experience compared to us in building code. So he was the CEO, but all of us worked on building the core technology. As the company started to grow, then I think the personality of each one of us pushed each one of us to the right corner within the company. Guy became the CTO. I became more customer facing. Eldad kept being the CEO. Adi was focused on the growth part of the company. So each of us found its corner within the organization based on what he brings to the table and the interaction between us.
I mean, that sounds so romantic, but like, people's personalities aren't always like such a puzzle. And of course, we always discuss how it's important to find people that complete you and that you can't be surrounded by the same. And it's beautiful to hear how you all sort of fell into place. But I'm also finding it a little hard to believe. Like, it couldn't have been smoothing. There must have been clashes. It must have been like, people have egos, and you were young, so ego is even like more dominant in human interactions. So how were you able to navigate this relationship that with time actually stressed had to become something that is, you know, always in there with you as the fifth founder?
So don't get me wrong. It was far from being just roses and a walk in the park. We were fighting and yelling and arguing with a lot of passion, like good Israelis, but a lot of passion throughout the journey. I think what kept us together was the friendship between us and the trust that we have between us. But we had endless arguments. I remember that after we started to have employees in the company, we would have meetings between us. We went to the meeting rooms, and we didn't know how to argue back then. We yelled, and we fought, and we argued. And when we went out, I saw a few employees. I saw in their eyes, they thought that the company is breaking. However, we went out of that meeting room, and later that day, went to the local bar, all of us together. So in a way, it was very contained. So this is point number one. Point number two, I was a long period of time in the company. Not all of the founder stayed with the company throughout the 15 years I've stayed there. Adi left at some point, I think after 10 years, right? We stayed many years together. But at some point, the company grew tremendously and became very global. We had external leadership to the company. You know, we spiced the leadership with external professional leaders. And the you called it the romantic positive picture was less appealing to few of us. And it was, we were not happy about it, but it was understood by us throughout the journey. So I think Adi was the one that left at the beginning, and then...
The traitor.
No.
Kidding.
I think the company grew. He didn't feel he found his way or his position within the company that in a way that suits his ambitions or his perspective. And now, first, he's a friend of mine, and I'm one of his admirers. And he's a successful CEO of another startup today. Workies.
At the end of the day, when there's a company, you can't actually find positions for the founders themselves because their position was entrepreneurial. Like that's one of the hardest pinpoints. Now that you invest, okay. So looking at the team, okay. So let's put it this way: there's things that you could have done better, okay. So saying your own sense, but the other sense is you had an X factor in the teammates founding the company, okay. So how do you combine what you know you want the entrepreneurs to do, but also not organized enough so you also see their agility and chemistry and, you know, their X factor in the future?
So at some point at the company, after the first few early round of funding we got from VCs, we didn't grow as we expected to grow, and we went to our VCs and we asked again for money. talking about struggles along the way. And at some point, they told us, okay, we gave you enough money. We'll give you more money, but bring some professional assistant to the company at the form of a professional CEO. Back at the days, we didn't like it, obviously. We actually hated it. But in a hindsight, the professional CEOs, most of them at least, that we brought to the company are a very important part of the success and the growth of the company. In a hindsight, it's easier in the hindsight, to understand that. Back in the days, we didn't like it, but we didn't know what we're not, what we do not know. Now I know. And it was, in a way, it saved the company, and it brought the company the momentum that it needed. And it's because of that. Obviously.
So it sounds like the investors that ended up collaborating with you were actually smart money and were truly helping you see your blind spots, right?
Correct. And yeah. And first, our investors are great investors. I think of many well-known ones from established VCs. And they helped us and guide us. They confronted us. They made our life hard, but at the same time, they hold our hand and helped us grow and succeed and grow the company.
And were you in a position where you actually chose your VCs, or was this more about we'll take money from whoever will give us? And I'm asking specifically because you were detailing the struggle of actually shifting from angel investments to institutional. So I'm wondering how much did you feel in control at that stage, or did you sort of luck out in that sense?
So the dynamics of raising funds for a startup is heavily dependent on what is the status of the company, right? If the company is exploding in a very good way, many times it's up to the company to choose their investors. When the company is not experienced that explosion, like Sisense at the early days, you take money from whomever you can take money. I hope it answers your question.
Okay, so yeah. Okay, I don't want to put you in a corner, but did you feel like the majority of the investors were actually, you know, in the same mindset as you and helping you in a good way, or were some such that in retrospect you would have, if you were not, you know, the beggar that can't be a chooser, would choose differently?
It's very hard to answer that question because you never know. You never know, you know, which decision you took and what was the real impact of that. Our first institutional investor that believed in the company was Dan Avida from Opus Capital. I consider him as a friend. He's a super smart person, super experienced in that area. He is very smart. He's not easy to work with. And I think this is part of the charm and probably one of the reasons we were able to grow.
On that sense, there's a notion of actually having difficult to work with investors is an advantage, not a disadvantage. Not in a sense that you don't want to work with them very well. Just because, especially in younger ages of entrepreneurs, the challenges, okay, that they give is something that makes people a little bit better. You know what I mean? Like when you said about like not choosing the investors, sometimes it's an advantage of getting, you know, investors that are really hard on you. It's like those parents as a metaphor, you know, like
tough
those,
love.
Yeah, the tough love kind of vibe. What do you think?
So here is my perspective on it. The best investor that I've experienced, for others it might be different, were the investors that their value to the company wasn't only their checkbook. Their value to the company was guiding helping the management of the company, steering their way in the turbulence, advising the founders and the leadership of the company, opening doors, and helping the company through the very challenging growing the company journey that it is. I think the least you can ask from an investor is just give me the money and don't interfere. If you're lucky enough, you can find someone that gives you money, but also give you added value. That's what I try to do in my investments. Hopefully the founders that I work with feel it. But this is, if I try to imagine myself as a successful investor, this is how I imagine myself. Someone that is able to really work shoulder to shoulder with the founders and the leadership of the company and provide them value that is not just access to capital.
What do you look for in teams that come to you? How do you know it's something that you want to invest in?
That's also a great question. Many VCs will tell you this is the $1 billion question, how to smell the team and recognize it's a great team. I don't think there is a mathematical answer to that. I'll tell you what the sentiments that I'm looking when I look into the team. First, unsettled fire in their personality to build something, because here is a story, okay, that I think a lot about when I meet teams. After the turbulence or the difficulties of growing or building a size at the beginning, at some point we started to succeed, right? And I remember that I moved to the States, to New York, to start the U.S. entity of the company. It was 2013, I think. And we opened an office in New York, and then we started to hire the go-to-market people, and we started to grow. And then we had a board meeting, and we decided to host the board meeting in our office in New York. I told you about Dan and Vida that, again, I really love and look up to. He came to our office, and I was a bit arrogant. I told him, Dan, look at our office. See how many people we have in New York. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. We're growing the sales and the team. And everything is great. And then Dan, again, super smart, he told me, Aviad, hold your horses, okay? If I need to sum it up, the only thing you did very successful is to keep your head above the water long enough and not dying. If you do that long enough, at some point you'll get your chance. You'll start to see the positive thing that, the coins that start to trickle down in the machine. And it was very humbling discussion with him that made me think how important is the grit or the resilience and to keep on, you know, to the next step, not the entire journey. Every time you meet a challenge and not giving up.
Like, that sounds a very difficult conversation to have. So I'm wondering, what steps did you end up taking? Like, how did this shift your mindset in a way that was felt in your actions?
Well, in few ways. First, it formalized to me that there's no magic spell to how to build your company. And if you need to find one common denominator, and it's very hard between successful companies, at least that I know, that they all struggle. It's never easy, at least unless you're Wiz. But if you're not Wiz, it's never easy. And if you have the grit, if you have the resilience, and you keep on going, maybe it will not ensure your success, but it's a very important part of it. This is what this conversation crystallized to me today. And going back to your original question, what I look into when I look into potential founders or teams, that internal flame that potentially will keep them going through the struggles, because there are going to be storms and struggles, but they will keep along. This is one sentiment that I'm looking for. Second sentiment is the joy of creation. Okay, so we talked about the struggles. Obviously, major part of the journey. They need to find the joy in that journey. The bad and the good, right? The struggles and the success. The people that it doesn't spark joy in them, the ups and downs, would be very difficult for them. They need to be super smart, obviously. It's a good indicator for general success. And the team needs to be as complete as possible, meaning nobody is perfect. I'm far from being perfect. There are things that I'm good at and there are things that I'm not good at. If the team complete itself, it's a good indication of a good team. With all of that, we still make a lot of mistakes, and it's very hard to get to that conclusion about a team.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high-tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, C-A-L-C-A-L-I-S-T-E-C-H.com, to stay up to date on all high-impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
Aviad, so this is the thing. Yeah, like you're totally an entrepreneur. I hear also the enthusiasm also, and like sounds to me like I have a tricky question. Do you miss it?
That's a very good and a bit personal question, but I'll answer it. Yes, at times I miss it. I did it for a long period of time. So I had my chunk of these struggles, the ups and downs, and the entrepreneurial experience. Every once in a while, I think about what if, you know, the what if question. What if I started a new venture, yes or no? Currently, my decision is no. Okay, we didn't talk about me as an investor, but this is something that I learned that I really love as well. But every once in a while, I open my laptop and think, damn, I miss coding. Or damn, I miss going on a hunt for new customers or new partners and such.
I have to say this on my sense. I'll tell you why. I'm asking, so I'll be personal as well. I really miss it. Like, on the investor side, okay, it actually frustrates me immensely. Okay, to enable other people doing things. It's not that I'm not happy to do it or say it, but it frustrates me, especially when I know that I want to do it. I'm enthusiastic about it, and maybe I can even do it better sometimes, right? I don't know. When I was told I was being an investor, okay, I didn't know that it's this kind of job. It sounded to me super amazing as opposed to being an entrepreneur. When I did it, it's actually, it felt for me, I'm not saying for you, more of a hedging job, right? More and I miss the risk taking, the responsibility for good or for bad, you know what I mean? And especially, like the spotlight. So on that side, in that sense, that's why I asked you the question. And the question is this: are you looking for entrepreneurs, which again, not the answer, but entrepreneurs that are challenging for you to work with or that you are similar to?
I'm not sure. I think if I try to look back at the teams that I've been working with, I think I have a little bit of both.
What do you learn from them?
First, as an investor, at least, I'm as good as my founders, right? It's all about the founders. They're doing the work. I'm a supportive function in terms of capital, advice, and such. It's all about them. And fortunately, the founders I've been working with are great founders, personally, mentally, and such. So I learned from each one of them, to be, to be honest, each one of them is different from one another, right? I don't know if you have kids. I have three kids. Each one of them is completely different from one another. The way I interact with him, the way I challenge him, the way he challenged me, it's completely different. Eventually, when we work with team, we work with humans, and they're different from one another. And I think part of the magic is to understand how to engage and work with each team based on what the team is. It's part of the challenge. And maybe, to your question, it's a good segue to talk a little bit about Team 8, because the reason why I chose Team 8, I think, communicates with the entrepreneurial question you had earlier today. When I decided to depart from Sisense, so I spent 15 years at Sisense. The last 7 years I spent in New York. And when I moved back after 7 years, when I moved back to Tel Aviv, then I started to have existential thoughts about what I want to do in my life. And I informed the board, and we departed. I departed from the company. If you ask me back then, what's going to be my next step? Obviously, some time off, but starting a new company. At the last few years that I was with Sisense, I started to become an active angel investor. It started not because I wanted to be an angel investor. It started because many founders came to me for advice or guidance, things like that. A few of them, I was very intrigued, so I decided to put some money at them. When I departed from Sisense, I had much more spare time. So I started to do it at a higher velocity. I met more teams, more systematically, with friends, without friends. And I started to invest a little bit more. But in my mind, I was taking the time until I start my new thing. Now, maybe we can have psychological explanations, but I didn't end up starting a new venture. It didn't happen, although I thought I would. Now, you know what the number one characteristic of a founder? The number one characteristic of a founder is that he wants to be a founder. He wants to start something, right?
Right.
And probably at this point of time, maybe I told myself that I want to start something, but I didn't. So I wasn't.
Right. Okay, that's a good one.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I met teammate a bit earlier than this point of time, but at that point of time, my interaction with Team 8 was, Aviad, you told us a couple of years ago or a while ago that you don't want to be as an investor or VC, but look at you. You're investing in companies, you're involved with many or few funds. You can say you do not want to be a VC, but practically what you're doing on your day-to-day is somewhat a VC, and it made sense. But I think what really caught my attention with Team 8 is the model, the motion that they build internally that is very collaborative with the founders. Team 8, and now I'm included part of it, is focused on joining teams very early. Sometimes when the idea that they have is a tag name, not more than that. Sometimes we even partner with teams or founders that they don't have ideas. We constantly work internally, a teammate, on building thesis. And sometimes we do the matching. So this kind of motion for me in my dictionary was a little bit in between, right? It's not just sitting in my ivory tower and deploying capital. It's a little bit more collaborative. It's like rolling up my sleeves and partnering with founders that I'm passionate for and help them as much as they allow me to help them.
It's sort of like founding the founders. It's like...
Words have meaning. The companies belong to the founders, right? We are just supporting and focus on that.
Yeah, no, totally. I understand that you're empowering these people. I agree. But the thing is, at the end of the day, it is a founding job, and like a team. And the way you describe it now in Team 8 is actually that sometimes you even found the idea,
the structure of,
and also the founder specifically for that idea. I'm not saying it's there, okay, which is, you know, which is,
it happens.
You know, if you remember the story about Adi, you said about Adi, he left after a few years. If you leave after a few months, after you have the idea and all the team ready, it's still, you know, a very entrepreneurial kind of way to invest.
Yeah, but, you know, reflecting the story that I told you about my journey at Sisense, one of the conclusions is that idea is important. However, it's not too important. It's all about the execution and how you navigate that idea in the turbulence of the journey.
And those entrepreneurs that you were describing that sometimes don't even have an idea, that's like the concept of entrepreneur in residence, right?
Not exactly. It's a variation of that, I would say. I don't know. I don't want to I'm trying to avoid templatizing it. But we have teams, and if they don't have a thesis or a strong enough thesis, or sometimes we work on a thesis that they brought into the table, but we figure out together that maybe it's not the best thesis to work on, we have our teams, internal teams, big teams, by the way, of business researchers and technical people and biz dev people that and motions that we build internally that help us build a pipeline of thesis that we explore either alone before we have founders and sometimes with the founders.
So sometimes it's basically, or maybe all the time, it's about investing in the people above the idea.
It's always about the people. Always about the people.
I mean, I have one more question about that. So you're a developer, right?
I used to be. I didn't write code in few years, unfortunately.
But how did you know that you're really good at communication and business as well? Because you're very uniquely, sorry for the stigma, but you're very uniquely like social,
not even
an introvert, but very like even when the whole podcast right now, you didn't have even the tech acronyms in there, right? Which is amazing. Like
it's
how did
like
you
a very human?
No tech acronyms. You're like you can say humanizing it, but still, how did you know that you have that part? Because
like the people,
you know,
skills.
Yeah.
So a few things around that. First, I told you, we work with many teams, our founders, even with a very hardcore technical background that knows how to communicate very well, even better than I am. So I'm not that unique in that regard. I even know, it's a good observation, I even know people, founders, that are very smart. And I mention it because they are introvert. However, they are super smart and they know that part of the job is to be outspoken and out there. So they build a system. They look at the challenges of life as if they look at a programmatical problem. And they build a model how to position themselves as people that can be outspoken. I know I one founder that I really, really like, he used to tell me that every time he had a social event that he had to take as a founder, right, to host like delegation and stuff like that afterwards, he had to take like a day off and just crumble in his bed, just lying under the blanket, not talk to anyone because it was draining energy-wise to do that. So he knows how to build the model, the mental model, how to mitigate that challenge.
I really like that because it truly goes to show that at the end of the day, comfortable or not, people are able to optimize themselves as long as they're able to understand what is now required. And I think that's such a beautiful approach. Instead of sort of all these exclamation marks and saying, I'm not, you know, fill in the blanks, just figure out, okay, I'm less comfortable in, but here is how I can.
Yep. Obviously, you need to be very honest with yourself. The fact that you can do it doesn't mean you are the best in doing that. And it's also fine because none of us are good at everything.
Right. Right. It's striking that balance between those two ends. Like, don't over avoid, but be also humble and understand where you're just not the one who is the best for this specific job.
If you'll ask my wife, she will tell you about endless things that I'm not good at.
So speaking about that, actually, let's start with what you are. What would you say your superpower is?
Oh, I don't like talking about myself.
Yeah, you're clearly very modest. So this is a question that's putting you on the spot. But if you have to say...
I think I'm okay with people. I have okay people skills.
Okay, yeah, I think that's very evident. And then, what's your kryptonite? What's your weakness?
I tend to be very uncomfortable with people that you know, when they try to convey an idea that they cannot convey. They do wave convincing, hand waving convincing. I have very low tolerance for that. And it's completely fine that somebody doesn't know something. But for me, it's I've low tolerance for that. And I have, how do you say it in English? I have kotzim batachat. I cannot sit. I like being in motion, in action, and push things forward constantly. If there is something that blocks me,
you get it out of the way.
Yeah.
If people want to pitch or collaborate with you in any way, is there any preferable way to reach out to you?
I hope that this is the reality, but I consider myself as very accessible. So just write me an email, WhatsApp me, meet me at the street. I'll try as much as my calendar allows it. My job is constantly to talk to people, to learn about them, to learn about what they think about things. I always learn something, for good or bad, but I learn something. So I try to think myself as accessible as possible. So yeah, if you are a founder, I told you, if you think you are a founder, which means you decided you're taking action, right? I am a founder. And you took it seriously, not because of the hype or the... you know, the vibes around that, but if you truly want to be a founder, reach out. I want to talk to you.
And if you had that's a question for today, just tell me this. If you had to say one thing to the entrepreneur today, which is, you know, the entrepreneurs that hit the inflation and the corona and, I don't know, maybe worry, depends where you are in the geography and politics and whatever, what would be the one thing you would tell them today to the entrepreneur?
Being focused and resilient is, I think, two key components in how to manage these challenges, right? If you build an internal conviction about a problem first and you validated it, right? I talk to my team a lot, and one of the things I tell them when we consider a thesis, tell them, I really like my thesis. Nobody cares about the fact that I like them. I need the market to like these thesis. So if you have a great conviction of a problem and you got the validation from the market, and you're super focused on that and not being drifted by everyone that talks to you, and you have the resilience to keep on going, I think these are the two best thing you can have in your arsenal in order to overcome these challenging times.
Thank you so much for stopping to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Aviad.
I enjoyed very much our conversation. Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Also, if you have a moment, we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review our podcast on the platform you're listening to. This will help others find our show. And as always, if you know anyone who you think would enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back as usual on the first of the month.
Real. Live.
Superpowers.
Live.
Superpowers.